You are listening to an episode of the Elephant in the Room podcast brought to you by the Purpose Room in partnership with the India Justice Report. Each month, we will bring to you insights on the workings of the Indian justice system. We will also explore the notion of justice and what it means to Indians. My guests on this episode of the Elephant in the Room podcast are Maya Daruwala and Valay Singh from the India Justice Report. Maya is the chief editor of the India Justice Report, a barrister from Lincoln's Inn. She's been working to advocate for rights and social justice for over 40 years. Previously, she was the director of Commonwealth Human Rights Initiative and a board member of the Justice Initiative at Open Society Justice Institute, New York. She sits on several charitable boards, including the Population Foundation of India and Center for Social Justice. Valay Singh is the project lead of the India Justice Report, reports 2019 and 2020. A published author, he regularly writes for Indian and international publications. Valay is also the author of Ayodhya, City of Faith, City of Discord, and is currently working on his new book on the holy city of Varanasi.
Good afternoon, Maya. Good afternoon, Valay. Thank you for making time for the Elephant in the Room podcast and for our first introductory episode. Thank you for being here today.
Love to be here. Thank you so much for having us.
So I'll just get started with the questions. Congratulations to you and the team on bringing out the brilliant India Justice Report. So tell us, what is the India Justice Report so that our listeners have a basis for understanding the conversation that we're going to have today?
The India Justice Report is the first of its kind quantitative assessment of the capacity of the four pillars of the justice system. What does it do? It takes data from only government sources. It divides it into these four pillars: police, prison, judiciary, and legal aid. It then further divides it into six themes of infrastructure, workload, human resources, diversity, trends. And then for each theme, it has a bunch of metrics or indicators. These would be, you know, the share of women in, say, police. It would be the judge to population ratio. It would be the caseload. Let's go to legal aid. It would be the coverage of legal aid in a particular state. So it brings all these siloed data sets about the different pillars of the justice system in one place. And it ranks 25 states, divided into two clusters, one cluster being the 18 large and mid-sized states, and then seven small states. So for the very first time, we have a resource where you can see how the capacity of a justice system in a particular state is, either as a whole or for one of the pillars or two of the pillars. This is what India Justice Report does. This is what it has added to the discourse around justice in India.
And of course, this report is quite unique in the sense that there's nothing of this kind at this point in time.
Yes, there isn't anything of this kind at the moment. And also, it doesn't have any subjective assessment. What do I mean by that? We would like to, but we haven't gone and surveyed the public. We haven't gone and surveyed, say, select sample size of lawyers or applicants or policemen. What we have done is we have looked at what are the benchmarks a state has for itself. So what is the percentage of women it has decided for itself? And we see, has the state met its quota for women? Has the state fulfilled its quota for SCs, STs, OBCs? Has the state fulfilled its own sanctioned capacity of police officers? That's what we do. We do not provide our own judgments, which we of course have, but we have not done that in this report. Therefore, it is a sort of as pure reflection as possible of the prevailing capacity of justice system in India.
Brilliant. Thank you, Valay. So how did the idea of the report come about, and what is at the core purpose of bringing out this annual report? Clearly, it requires a lot of energy and work to bring something together. And it has to be supported with adequate passion because you believe in what you're doing.
Well, as the little subtitle says, the India Justice Report is an assessment of the capacity to deliver justice. We often talk about, in fact, the whole conversation is about the lack of access to justice, the slowness, the bias, some of the difficulties within the police, the status of prisons, the conditions in prisons, and so on. And there is a kind of hand-wringing about it. But then we wanted to look at solutions, but solutions have already been suggested many times. One of the things that people don't look at are the nitty-gritty of capacity. How many people are in this work? How much money do they get? What is the workload that they have to cope with? What is the infrastructure that they work within? So we wanted to put that out in a simple way where people could understand it. And then looking at it holistically, looking at all of the pillars holistically, through not opinion, but through facts, through statistics that the government itself publishes, look at police, prisons, legal aid, and judiciary to begin with. Yeah. And then every year, build on it, make comparisons and see what has improved and what is deteriorated. To basically give a tool to people to look at, policymakers, media people, influencers, so that when we talk, we argue and we discuss on the basis of facts rather than any kind of perception.
It's a very constructive tool so that you're not speaking in vague terms and anecdotal terms, but you're basing something on hard fact, data, and statistics, as you mentioned. So the report is based on publicly available data from the government entities and the judiciary. Is this like a third-party audit? And are you trying to enable, through the IJR, the India Justice Report, to help set benchmarks for the justice system?
Actually, the benchmarks are there already. If I can give you an example, for instance, reservations of scheduled castes, scheduled tribes. That's already there in government policy. How many women should you have in the police? That's already there. Benchmark is there of 30%, 33%. There are general policies also. There are model bills. There are model proposals that are put forward. The center gives the state guidelines. So there are many benchmarks that are already set. As far as third-party audit is concerned, I wouldn't put it that way. It was never intended as an audit. An audit seems to suggest a kind of judgment. But here, the facts are put in front of you as given in official data. But from that, then there is an easy pathway to analyzing, especially where there are comparisons. Why is one state doing so much better than another? Why is year on year things not changing? What is the intention of the state? If 5 years ago or 10 years ago, you had 7% women in police, and now after so many years, you still only have 10% in the police and they are clustered right at the bottom, then it throws up a conversation. It throws up questions about what are the recruitment practices? What are the practical difficulties of bringing women into the police? Are the excuses that are made, are the reasons that are given enough? Are they logical? Or could be changing mindset? If I can give you a good illustration, one of the reasons for not bringing in more women into the police, apart from the usual thing about the police being dangerous and macho and so on and so forth, is there is not enough facilities for women, not enough toilets. Where can women go? Now, this is an interesting, it's very practical, it sounds very logical. But my question then would be, how long would it take you to build toilets? And if there are toilets already, why are they exclusive to men?
Yeah.
Why are they not given to women? If your intention really is to bring about gender parity.
That's a very simple and powerful example, but the state across India, I think it's not just in the justice system, it's across government or private sector where facilities are a big challenge. So you have set the scope of the report covering six themes under the four pillars of the justice system. And these six themes that you're looking at is HR, diversity, budgets, workload, infrastructure, trends, How did you go about choosing these themes without compromising on what you've set out to do? Because the justice system is so vast and there are so many things. You can just get lost in trying to figure out what are the aspects that are critical to making an impact or helping change happen.
We were not working alone. You very kindly said that it was the India Justice team. But the team is actually comprised of 6 or 7 NGOs who are specialists in this. Common Cause, the Center for Social Justice, Daksh, Vidhi, Tata Institute of Social Sciences, and Prayas. Yeah. And we had a data partner in How India Lives. So we had a lot of thought people who had been working for a long time. And it was they and the Tata Trust who this report was nested at that time, who sat around and conceptualized what are the things that we would like to look at that are really vital to providing justice. You have to have human resources. You have to have budgets, proper budgets. You have to assess the workload. Is the infrastructure, the human resources, the budgets sufficient? Is the workload too heavy? And how do we assess trends? How do we assess whether things are going to improve? What is the intention of the state? Because over 10 years, you get elections, you get bureaucracies changing by oppression, you get governments changing by election. So is there a proper policy? Is our policies being followed? Are manifestos being followed? And who is oversighting these things? We would have liked to have done much more, but I should say this is a baby report. This is a nascent report. We've only had two editions, and the third one will come out in 2023. So it was to make a beginning that was rational and reasonable on which we could build. Some of it was, of course, dictated by the availability of data. But as we have gone along and become more and more educated, we are able to correlate across other reports as well, like Crime in India. And researchers, etc., are going to use this and take it much further. It's going to be a building block. And each year, we hope to add a little bit more. Last year, we added a bit on training, on technology. Yeah. One of the things that we really realized was how little money there is spent on training. Across the board, it's usually around between 1% to 3%, if it goes up to 3%. And yet, when you think about it, training creates the fundamental mindset, culture for the police, for the prisons, for the judiciary. And you look at the policy, for instance, I give you an example. The policy change across the years in prisons is to look at rehabilitation and the integration of people into society who come into the prison system, rather than revenge and retribution. This is the world over. But the question to be asked is, how much of the training actually takes you there? And if your training facilities are understaffed, under-resourced, haven't changed their curriculums for years, the promise of using human rights as the baseline and organizing principle for your training has actually not been realized, then you recognize why the culture in prisons is such, or the culture in policing is such. And this is what the report actually takes you to.
Yeah, to the heart of the matter. So the report does create some matrix of competitiveness and ranks states on police, judiciary, prisons, and legal aid, and compares changes in relation to other states. And over the last 5 years, and since the previous year's report also, the latest report I noticed has also added 10 new indicators to the previous 78. So how important is ranking, do you believe, to addressing these deep and systemic issues and structural issues? I'm sure you must have seen the response from the states and from the various stakeholders.
I think ranking, I was very nervous about it, frankly, because it creates the kind of controversy that you don't want, and it then goes into party politics and so on and so forth. But I think the ranking has been very, very useful. People should be ranked. Governments should be ranked for the performance that they provide to the people. And we mustn't be mealy-mouthed about it. And this ranking is not a ranking that is based on my opinion or yours. It is a ranking that they themselves have given us the statistics for. Our government has given us the statistics. We have no cause not to believe the statistics. And therefore, you live and die on the sword of statistics. And I think that one of the things that the ranking must be seen as is not merely a competitiveness within each other, like Maharashtra arguing with Tamil Nadu or arguing with Telangana, but rather it should be seen as a benchmark that you're making the effort to improve your state itself. You want to be first, and you want to be first next year as well, and the year after that as well.
Yeah.
The other thing that I would like to point out very much is that these rankings, because they are made up of pinpoints of information, by changing two or three things, you can actually improve the entire rank of the state. So some states, for instance, Bihar, the first report, it had a poor showing on women. And then suddenly, due to increases of women in the police, they improved it quite dramatically and their ranking went right up. Now, like all statistics, statistics only tell half a story. We have to also accept that. So each time we make the report, we try to nuance the report so that it is more and more accurate in terms of the reality that is on the ground. But low-hanging fruit, reducing the number of under-trials, reducing the congestion in prison, improving the amount of money that is spent on legal aid, or your contribution to that, the state's contribution to the central budget, can change your entire ranking. The changing of the entire ranking is, I would say, as a citizen, an incidental. What really matters is the value you give to your citizen, the speed of justice, the access to justice, the improvement in ground levels infrastructure, localization.
How have your stakeholders responded? Have you had support for it from states, or are there people who have come out to support the initiative? And what has been the feedback to the India Justice Report?
Actually, it depends on how you measure feedback. If it is a question of getting noticed, we have been well noticed. We presented to the Niti Aayog, which is the highest policy-making body in the country. We have presented to state governments. Bureaucrats have been interested in understanding what's happening. Everybody has welcomed this notion of having this holistic report to look at. It will definitely act as a reference point. There's no doubt about that. The media has been extremely kind, if you like. There's lots and lots of mentions of ourselves in the media. Where I see an outcome is I see that some reporting or much reporting is now quoting, much opinion reporting is quoting the India Justice Report as a validifying factor. Okay. So you're getting this mix of opinion and statistics and a reaffirmation of an argument because the India Justice Report shows it. So from that point of view, also there is a good outcome. I cannot say to you, because I wrote this, or because we showed this, suddenly there was a huge change. But undoubtedly, bureaucrats, legislators, etc., are feeling that, okay, if we are to be better, and people do want to be better, then we must improve X or Y. Whereas in Orissa, there's been a public interest litigation on decongestion of prisons. The Chief Justice has taken on board a lot of the stuff that we have said, so that he has the statistical arguments to point out to the people that he is giving direction to. And it becomes a monitoring tool also.
Absolutely. I think people finally, because most of the time the arguments around the problems in the justice system are like vague, anecdotal, and this gives you hard facts and data which you can present and actually take the conversation forward. And like you said, monitor if you can make that change and what is required to make that change. If you look at the report, it's very easy to see what they're ranked on and how they can, you know, so, okay, this is where the problem lies. This is what I need to do. I think that becomes probably an easier thing. And most people like that rather than vague stuff.
In terms of the judiciary, for instance, I think the stark figures that are showing up, 40 million cases, a shortage of judges, a tremendous shortage of judges, a tremendous shortage of infrastructure, budgets that are stagnating or going up very, very little. And I haven't calculated in real terms how much they are going up. We are seeing that in the high courts, the cases have gone up by 10% and in the subordinate courts by 5%. And there is long pendency. And this is going to have a huge knock-on effect. Now, it's not only the India Justice Report that points it out. But as we go year on year, we can now project what's going to happen in the next few years. And it is frightening. And people must start paying attention. This hiatus that we have had to go through during the COVID time, nearly 24 months of it, when the courts have not been able to function simply because of the physical constraints of sickness, courts closing down, etc., presents a moment in which to think radically and change things radically, because going on as usual is going to only drop us in the mire in a terrible way. Yeah. And in the absence of this fundamental organizing principle of rule of law in a society, the breakdown of society is almost prophesied. And I think that this kind of dead serious stuff can be bolstered by something like the IJR, but it is key to change things, because this is never going to be business as usual. Business as usual is going to lead to bankruptcy.
Yeah. You've referred to COVID in the last 24 months and how they've exacerbated across the world existing inequalities. And of course, it's very visible in the justice system. Which are the areas most impacted, Maya, specifically in India? COVID must have set back any progress that has been made, probably.
As I said, I don't think it is at all feasible to continue in the same vein as before. You're going to have to take radical steps. A great deal of these steps lie in the bailiwick or the mandate of a state government, how prisons are functioning, how justice is dispensed. You're going to have to create imaginative solutions. And they are there. They are there in those musty reports that have been lying there for years and years and years. But at the moment, there is perhaps not sufficient incentive or push from the public, as well as there is a great constraint of finances. And that makes the struggle to increase infrastructure. But again, I think it is a false economy to say we don't have enough money to hire judges and we don't have enough money to improve training. There are two ways, there are many ways, but two of the ones that I can easily talk about is just to increase human resources. But increasing human resources without training and without getting everybody on the same page to understand what the rule is, what the processes are, how to clear your backlogs, etc. If you have more and more untrained manpower, you're not going to get anywhere. And a good example of this is the police. You cannot keep on increasing the police if you are not going to train them and change their mindsets and ensure that they are protectors and promoters of the rule of law. If you are going to get a brutalized police, a police that is under strain, a police that cannot, in fact, hold down crime or solve it or detect it, except in the most brutal and cruel of ways, then it's virtually no use to have that. So there, perhaps, the accent needs to be a smaller manpower or the same manpower with much more logical deployment, better hours of work, better conditions of work, and by far much, much more better training in how to process the law, how to implement the law, and not having this large cohort of people who is only used to suppress.
You have two reports, and across the two reports, have you noticed some trends which, of course, as you said, it'll help us to think and predict in the long term what is going to happen, what the situation is going to be? And has the pandemic sort of inhibited your ability to report on these trends? Are you still going to be able to get the data and the statistics because of the situation that we've been in for the past 2 years?
I think to answer your second question first, I think it is going to be quite a challenge to get all of the data that we need to report as we have reported before. We are also being a bit ambitious and adding pillars. So that is going to be quite a challenge, but we will try and attempt to make that challenge as successful as possible. And we may have to make certain changes, etc., which we will do. India was and is known to have good statistics. When I say good statistics, many people collecting them. And without that baseline, I think we would be in major difficulties. But as we go through a diminution of resources, governmental resources, if this impacts on those agencies that gather data and attenuate the collection of data, we are going to be in difficulties. You were asking me about trends and major findings over 2 or 3 years. Unfortunately, I don't see too many positive trends. There are trends that are sort of stagnating as they normally would. Things are going on. But there are too many negative continuations, if you like. Yeah. Vacancies have stagnated. Access to institutions remains skewed in favor of urban populations and not rural populations. Occupancy in prisons, especially those of under trials, that is people who are technically innocent until their trial is done. And we don't find a reduction in that. And it's quite stark, Sudha. Between 65 to 71% of all your inmates in prison are under trial. And then at the same time, you have congestion. So you're putting your population at risk while they await access to justice. And this is not something that a country like India, with its democratic tradition, should be saying. Then you see the situation of women. The glass ceiling persists. Now, you can't say that women in India are not educated, or that there is not a whole cohort of women who are ready and available for employment in every sphere. And yet the women that are recruited into the justice system inevitably find themselves in subordinate courts, find themselves in the constabulary or in the lower ranks of prison wardens, but not in the officer category, not in the Supreme Court so much, though there have been changes recently. The Chief Justice has spoken many times about the need for diversity. And while we talk about women, because they are so obviously differentiable from men, there are other diversities that need to be addressed, religious diversities. Yeah. There must be a representation in the justice system because the justice system itself must be just. So therefore, you must be able to reflect the population. If there are X percentage of Muslims, Y percentage of Christians, Z percentage of Buddhists, a percentage of scheduled tribes, all these must be represented. And this argument that for some reason, for years and years, merit has only been positioned in the upper classes, whether caste-wise or income-wise, is just such a lot of crock.
I think if the intent is there, change is very much possible.
And you have to recognize that the fact that there has not been changed is an indication of bias.
Absolutely.
It's not a neutral thing. It didn't just happen.
That's true. So moving on, it isn't a very recent study, but I think it must still hold true. A study by Daksh found that most Indian preferred non-judicial mechanisms for dispute or conflict resolution because they think it is too expensive or complex or cumbersome and slow, of course. And the average Indian doesn't want to engage or understand the system unless absolutely forced to do so. Why is that? And how important is it for citizens of any country to be more savvy about the justice system? My own experience, I can tell you, when I was growing up in India and I lived there for a long time, is that I think there is a sort of fear of that entire system. You don't want to get anywhere close to it for whatever reason.
Well, if you're talking about the court system, I mean, justice is dispensed at many stages. If you're in difficulties on the road, you should go to a policeman. If you are in a civil dispute, you want to go to a mediator or you want to go to court. If you are a large corporation, you want arbitration. And you're right, the system functions slowly. It has great complexity of rules and regulations. And it is reliant at this moment on who you get to arbitrate, whether it is two lawyers or whether it is an arbitration or whether it is a judge. And 40 million cases. If you have 40 million cases, you are waiting in line. And perhaps you can't wait in line. You're an ordinary man or woman with an ordinary tenant. That is your main income source. You can't wait 5 years to get that person out. Or a person who is wrongly turned out of his house. He can't live on the street for 10 years while you decide. The other big problem, and I see this as fundamental, is that in all these 75, 78 years, we have not educated our population on their rights. Whenever I say this, somebody comes out of the woodwork and says, what about duties? Rights and duties go hand in hand. If I tell you about my right, even in this conversation, you will immediately tell me about yours.
Yeah.
So we are equal, but we have found a common language for dispute resolution. So we don't have to attack each other, burn each other's houses, do something to each other's children. We don't have to do that because we know where our right stops and your right begins. So this we have not done. So what happens is most people live in their social reality when there is actually an alternate paradigm, which is the constitutional paradigm, which could help you. The social reality will keep a child out of its rights because a child belongs to the family or to the parents and has no rights in the social reality. Whereas as soon as you say that a child has got rights and the parents understand it and the aunties and uncles understand it, that you can't beat a child to death, that you must send it to school, that you have to give it decent food, that you can't sell it off to your neighbors. So all that comes into play only when you know.
I want to say that the Justice Report is also trying to bring out the interconnectedness of these various core pillars of the justice system, right? So if you take the figure of 40 million cases as the problem, from there, if you analyze, you will see, okay, everybody talks about this 40 million and judge shortage. But to support a judge, you need support staff, you need translation facilities. In order for a judge to decide a case, the judge needs to have seen the evidence. For the evidence to be collected, there should be trained and enough policemen. For the accused to represent himself or herself, if the accused needs it, the accused should be given free legal aid. And I want to just say that prisons should be seen as the receptacle, as the last point of all the problems of the justice system, the malfunctioning, the inefficiency, and so on. And in prisons, instead of reformation, what we see is kind of this recidivism, which means that basically people who enter prisons come out as criminals, or at least more aware of how crimes are committed and so on, and they are not reformed. So this is just what I wanted to say. Justice Report's purpose is to break the silos, and the government also works in silos for all these four pillars, and bring it all together. That's why we have a composite ranking along with pillar ranking. So when we go to government, we say, look here, I'm not telling you only about your judge shortage. I'm also telling you about your legal aid coverage in your state. I'm also telling you that in your prisons, you don't have correctional officers. And in your police, you don't have enough women, you don't have enough, and so on. So that is what we try to do. We present a holistic picture. And this is for the first time that we've started this conversation. We've also started conversations on budgeting for justice, which was not really talked about before.
It's very interesting, because I don't think things will change within the justice system if you look at just one pillar or another pillar or just one part of it. It needs this wholesale change that is required. It can be incremental, but it needs to change. And I feel very positive, actually, about the future, in the sense that more and more young people are interested in understanding how processes work and how things work. And hopefully things should change because of that. And all of us become more aware of what our rights are guaranteed under the Constitution. So Maya, we have two reports so far, the 2019 and 2020. And I understand that you had some support. You mentioned the NGOs and the third parties that you worked with for the first two. Ensuring that the India Justice Report has a strong foundation and is sustainable must be a big priority for all of you. How challenging has it been in reality to do that, to ensure that you have the resources in order to get this out? It's hard work. It's like intense.
It certainly is very, very intense. And I think Valet will be more able to speak about that than I. But we have a really good cohort of people, and we are learning as we go along, and we are learning to be deeper, more nuanced, come up with more arguments, look more carefully at data, position data better. As far as support is concerned, it is a struggle. We keep things down to the bare minimum of 4 or 5 people who have to be looked after. We hardly travel. We need support from all sorts of people, but we have a very modest budget. I think we'll manage for the next report, but then we'll have to struggle again to find more funds. But I'm hoping that the reputation of the India Justice Report, its value and use as we go along, will draw people to support it.
Well, any thoughts?
No, I would just say that in any case, justice is a sector which doesn't get much support in general. But we've tried to present this quantitative analysis in an interesting, easy to understand manner. So we are hopeful that as we go along and develop a very interactive website, basically create a tool for all sorts of justice data sets in India, we will get more supporters. And there are people who want to support. Sometimes they can't give us financial support, but they offer us support in other ways. So yeah, it's going along fine. I just want to say something else on the COVID thing. What we should expect, you know, it would be safe to say that there could be a flood of cases waiting to enter our courts once the pandemic is officially over and goes back to more physical courtrooms and so on. And to handle that additional sudden burden of cases, we are not preparing. We have the latest prison statistics for India. And according to those, in fact, the vacancies have not been filled up. Doctors have not been hired. We haven't got the data yet, so I can't say for sure. But this story is likely to be the same for police for sure. And there is a lot of talk about technology, but I think it is the right time to underscore that technology is not a cure-all sort of a solution. It has to be watched and it has to be under oversight. And there is, in fact, no substitute for actually trained judges or trained human resources. And we need to prepare for that as we hopefully come out of COVID in the next 6 months or so.
You're expecting a tsunami of cases and the courts to be overwhelmed, possibly.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. I remember in my first conversation, Maya mentioned that you're very keen for people to understand and start considering the paradigm that we live and work under, the Indian Constitution, the paradigm of the Indian Constitution and the rule of law, and how critical it is for a democracy to actually flourish. And if you have systemic issues within the justice system, it impacts not just the under trials and not just those who are caught up in that system, but all aspects of our life. So that was very interesting for me. So coming from that point of view, Maya, you've done two reports. What would future success look like, considering that that was the foundation of what you are trying to do?
One thing that success would really look like for me would be if I saw a replication of this in the States by other civil society groups, by other think tanks, or if someone, let us say, in a small district in Tamil Nadu, decided to do a report like this about their own district in Tamil and then disseminated it and then advocated around it. If we could see what justice at the localized level looks like, have you got the capacity in your area? And how does it compare to a capacity that is in another area, perhaps, which has another demography? Yeah. Does it make a difference to the delivery of justice if you are a majority Muslim area or a majority Dalit Toli? How do women receive justice in a district? At this moment, we are looking at capacity. We are not looking at the people who want to access justice, the formal system of justice. I often wonder, and nobody has done this kind of study, how many women actually, through their own agency, initiate a case. If they are not taken to the police station or to the court to, let us say, ask for property, and she cannot go there alone, or how many of them actually go there alone and say, I know enough about this to go and register my complaint? There just isn't. And that means that you're keeping 100% of one part of the population out of the ability to access justice. One of the stories, Sudha, that I remember from when I was a lawyer, was a little girl of about 18 or 19 sitting outside a courtroom. For the whole morning, I saw her when I went in, and at 5 o'clock when I was passing by that courtroom, I saw her again. And I went to her and I asked her what the problem was. And she said she was waiting for a trunk and 4 petticoats that she had in that trunk, which her lover had denied her, or her husband had denied her. And this lawyer had kept her there the whole day. And this was the 6th or 8th month of her pursuing this. And I never forgot that. We did something about it and all that, but that's different. But that is the level of what people want. They want their petticoat back.
Absolutely. And they should be able to get it back.
Yes. And what was the lawyer doing? What had he told her? How long had she been there? How much money had she spent? What was she exchanging with the lawyer to get this much service? It was frightening.
So clearly, I think success would be, like you mentioned, it would be if more and more people at the state level, at the local level, try to emulate what you're doing and try to ask questions and also advocate around those issues, around the challenges that they face.
Statistics at the moment I'm thinking about, because I'm immersed in this, but it's much more than statistics. It's understanding the previous recommendations that have been made, pressing for them, getting public opinion to see the value of the rule of law.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that is not happening. I would say there is a recrudescence of societal mores which we thought were going away. Things to do with inequality, things to do with dispute resolution being settled through violence or the use of power and might, the recrudescence of identities rather than equality. I think we are seeing more of that than I am seeing of the firming up of the rule of law.
From IJR, just from the report's perspective and the fact that we work with data, one of the things that success should look like is when policy around justice issues is based on evidence, which is not just generated by the government within the government, but which the government also takes from civil society and NGOs. success would look like when government applies a scientific formula to come up with a sanctioned strength of judges, a sanctioned strength of police, sanctioned strength of forensics. So basically, when policy will be based on real and solid data to cure the problems of the justice system, when we see any sign of that, it would be a success. This can only happen when justice is not event-based or a big announcement-based story. It would only happen when media, researchers, policymakers, politicians, they start looking at justice deficits, not only in terms of what catches the attention of the public, crime and violence, or the big numbers of 40 million backlog, but in the nitty-gritty that you actually have untrained constables dealing with innocent migrant workers going back home with lathis. And so success would look like a humane system which is designed on evidence and not expediencies of various kinds.
That's so true. And that's a wonderful way to sort of summarize all our conversation. Thank you so much, Maya. And thank you so much, Valay, for being here today. Really, I think this has been a very deep and insightful discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Elephant in the Room podcast, brought to you by The Purpose Room in partnership with the India Justice Report. Don't forget to subscribe to the show. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends.